slogan. It was impeach a turd, save a curd.
Yes. I love it.
That's what he left me with last night.
All rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Bradfoe, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. You may be seated. And I know that you both are familiar with argument here. When you begin, please state your name for the record. And the podium goes up and down if you want to adjust it for your height. You'll each have 15 minutes if you choose to use it and 5 minutes for rebuttal. In the first case is A19-0853. Is it Foser? How do you pronounce?
Foser.
Versus Jody Harpstead. And are you ready to begin?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may then.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Michael Leonard on behalf of the Commissioner of Human Services. Under 42 U.S.C. Section 1396 PC, when a Medicaid recipient over the age of 65 transfers assets into a pooled trust for less than fair market value, that person is subject to a transfer penalty in the form of a period of ineligibility. This appeal is about whether a respondent received fair market value when he gave up $28,000 in exchange for an agreement that he would get some of that money back over a period of years. The record evidence in the case is that the pooled trust into which respondent transferred that money has the following characteristics. First, respondent no longer has any legal right to access the funds. Second, respondent received nothing tangible of intrinsic value at the time of the transfer. Third, any distributions to respondent would be at the sole discretion of the trustee. Fourth, distributions could be made only for respondent's comfort and well-being and not for other purposes such as paying debts or giving gifts. And finally, at respondent's death, any funds remaining in the trust would pass not to his heirs or the beneficiaries of his estate, but to the state and to Lutheran Social Services. And none of these points is disputed. Rather, respondent argues that he received an equitable title at the time of transfer and that this equitable title is equal in value to the full value of the trust assets.
Before we go to the equitable title argument, I just want to make sure I understand some basics in the case. And I know that you and Respondent's Counsel are very familiar with this area of the law, and so I appreciate your comments in that regard. The very fundamental question, which both of you do touch on in your briefs, and the HSA also touches on in its decision, are what is the burden of persuasion or proof, and who bears that burden? So we have the HSA making contradictory statements about that. You're consistent in your brief, and you're consistent in your brief. But I see the HSJ making a variety of statements, first just reciting on ADD 13 that in an administrative appeal, the burden of proof is governed by state or federal laws, which is a pretty general, it's a correct statement, but it's a very general one. And then we go on a little bit further to it's ADD 16 in the confidential appendix, where it says the agency imposed the transfer penalty. You've already acknowledged that. The agency has the burden of showing by preponderance that the penalty was correct. So saying that the burden is focused on the agency. But then at the very end of the HSJ's decision, the HSJ implies that it was Mr. Foser who did not satisfy his burden, and that's at ADD 18. So would you shed some light on that? What to me is a very confusing discussion.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I'm glad you asked. There are two statutory provisions that are relevant. The first is Minnesota Statute Section 256B.0451, which generally states that the proponent of a fact in a proceeding has the burden of establishing that fact or proving that fact. In this case, the agency had imposed the ineligibility period, and Mr. Foser was challenging that decision, so the burden would properly be placed on Mr. Foser.
Well, what's the agency's burden, then, that the HSJ is referring to? Or are you telling me that the HSJ made a legal error?
Your Honor, I believe that the HSJ did misstate the burden, as you in the section of the decision that you noted.
But that's not something that you mentioned in your brief.
No, I did not, Your Honor. And the commissioner's position is that whichever party has the burden, the facts in the record are more than adequate to support the decision of the commissioner. The other statutory section that I'd like to call the court's attention to, which is more specific, is Section 256B.0595, Subdivision 4, which is very clear that an ineligibility period applies unless the MA recipient makes an affirmative showing that he received fair market value. And that's a very clear statement of law that applies to this case.
Well, that brings me to a question. You focus on fair market value, but it's or for other valuable consideration is the other part. It's a disjunctive. Mm-hmm. And I didn't find much discussion about that in your brief.
Sure. And the applicable cases, Your Honor, are very clear that the value received must be tangible value, and it must be something with intrinsic value. So what this court has to consider is whether the respondent received compensation in tangible form with intrinsic value at the time of the transfer. And to understand, I think, why this is the relevant inquiry.
Well, let's talk about at the time of the transfer, mm-hmm. because when I read the various statutes and regs, there doesn't seem to be a temporal limitation. Can you point me to where that's included in the law?
Certainly. So the clearest statement of that, I think, is the state Medicaid manual, which admittedly is not a source of law, but to which courts defer because CMS, of course, is charged with interpreting the Social Security Act. Section 3258.1A1, I believe, is the section of the state Medicaid manual that states that the compensation received must be in tangible form with intrinsic value at the time of the transfer. And the analysis in the Cox decision out of the Iowa Supreme Court references and applies that analysis. So again, to understand why that's an important consideration, we have to think about why Congress would not be concerned with transfers for fair market value in the first place. And the fact is that those types of transfers do not affect a person's total available assets for purposes of determining eligibility. They're simply exchanges of one type of asset for a different type of asset. But as long as each asset has intrinsic tangible value, then it can be counted as an available asset, and there's no real reason for the state to be concerned with the exchange of one for the other.
Let's talk about that. I realize that there's this age 65 cutoff, mm-hmm. and that's when the transfer was made here, but if the house had been sold 12 months earlier and the money had been put into this pooled trust when Mr. Foser was still 64, we wouldn't be here, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. Congress did place a hard cutoff of age 65 on these types of transactions. And there are a number of reasons why Congress reasonably could have chosen that as the cutoff. I think most obviously that's retirement age. It's when people maybe start to think about sheltering assets or how they can kind of structure things to arrange for themselves to be eligible for the great estate benefits as possible. It's also, given the legislative history, plain that these type of trusts were intended for adults to establish a trust to care for their children. There's, of course, not a legal obligation to care for your adult children. And so I think it made sense to Congress to, you know, permit a person to establish a trust for a child, but to maybe discourage them for doing from doing the same thing to care for themselves, since, of course, a person's assets can be counted when you're determining the available assets for their own care, if that makes sense.
Mr. Leonard, am I understanding correctly, too, that the pooled trust, perhaps not exclusively, but primarily or commonly is used for those with disabilities, most commonly under the age of 65. It just happens to be Mr. Fozer is both 65 or older, but he has the disabilities, and that's why prior turning 65, it would not have been an issue because he was disabled, he is disabled, and the pool trust, I'm assuming there's no dispute, qualifies under the statutes for a properly pooled trust. It's not a sheltering of assets. It's used for the benefit of the recipient beneficiary who is in long-term care for which those services are not otherwise provided under the MA statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so there's no dispute here that everything for which, in other words, there's no allegation or belief the appellant has that he's sheltering assets in this case, or did, I should say. The point being is it's a pooled trust that fits the purposes of it, and indeed it will be used for the benefit, is intended to be used for the benefit of his care.
It will be used for the for his comfort and well-being, Your Honor, that's correct. Because he's over 65, though, the statute does not contemplate that transfer, if it's uncompensated, would not count against his available assets for purposes of determining eligibility.
So I want to ask you a little further about that, Counsel. The argument I saw in respondent's brief, and I may have missed your response to it, but I just want to be clear, you know, it is a complicated set of statutes. So I'm specifically looking at 1396P, and you know, certainly gives the imposition of the penalty and explain how that works. But it also has some very specific provisions about the treatment of trusts amounts, and that certain trusts are excluded. And the argument made in respondent's brief is that there are certain criteria set out in, and now I'm in, subdivision D, right?
Yes, sir.
And down further under C, I'm guessing you know all of this stuff. There are four criteria set out that talk about the trust being established and maintained by a nonprofit, separate account being maintained for a pooled account solely for the benefit of the individual, established by a legal guardian of an individual, which happened here, and a court order also happened here, that to the extent amounts remaining in the account are remaining in the account upon the beneficiary's death, that they would go to the state. And that, it seems to me, in the argument made by respondent, is that this pooled trust satisfies all of those requirements for the exception.
It does satisfy those requirements, but the exception applies only if the recipient is age 64 or under at the time of the transfer of assets into
and
the pooled trust.
And where do you see that?
I could take one moment, Your Honor. It's 1396 PC.
But I'm in D, treatment of the trust amounts.
Let's see.
And this is certainly something you could address on rebuttal. I'm not trying to force you to spend all of your opening time on it. But I just want to be clear. I just didn't see that response in your reply. It may well be laid out there, and you can cite me to that as well.
Sure. So I would like to cite Section 1396 PC2B, which provides that an individual shall not be ineligible to the extent that the assets were transferred to a trust, including a trust described in subsection D4, which I believe is where Your Honor's looking,
mm-hmm.
established solely for the benefit of an individual under age 65 who is disabled.
All right, thank you. I'll take a look at that, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have a point of curiosity.
Of course.
So if Mr. Fozer, once he received this, let's call it $28,000 as his share from the family home, had gone out and bought an adaptive recliner, adaptive equipment for his wheelchair, workspace table, body positioning, pads, all those sorts of things, and had spent it down, is it a $15,000 amount that a person 65 and older can keep?
I don't have that information in front of me, Your Honor. And the spend down is not an issue in this case, I believe.
But my point is if he had done that, mm-hmm. and so his now what he received from the family home is under the amount, he would not have been penalized. Is that right?
I can't speak to that for certain. I know, of course, there is a spend down, and I'm not sure whether all of those expenses would qualify or not. To the extent that they would, you know, again, it would require an analysis of the law regarding the spend down. But it's potentially the case that some of them would not. I don't know whether all of them would count against him or not. And, Your Honor, in fact, respondent's refreshingly candid when he suggests that the pooled trust had value to him precisely because it would let him keep funds available for his benefit while shielding those funds for purposes of MA eligibility. In fact, the district court order authorizing the transfer of funds into the pooled trust expressly states that the purpose is to allow him to maintain MA eligibility while establishing this fund for his use or for use on his behalf. If the court accepts this argument, there's really nothing about this case that would be fundamentally different if the amount at issue were $100,000 or $1 million. All an individual would have to do is provide an itemized list of how he would like the money to be spent on his behalf. And by respondent's argument, that would be a transfer for fair market value. I respectfully request that the court reject that argument and uphold the decision of the commissioner.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you hear me? All right, thank you. Yeah. Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Leonard, may it please the court. My name is Lori Hansen, and I'm here today representing the respondent, now the estate of David Fosier, in a case that represents the culmination of 11 years of advocacy for individuals over the age of 65 who are living with a disability around what should be a very simple issue. Can a person age 64 and over establish a pooled trust subaccount and continue to receive medical assistance benefits to pay for long-term care? This issue has been visited multiple times in Minnesota over the years at both the administrative and the district court level, and in each case, the disabled individual has prevailed. The first district court decision was issued in December 2009 in Douglas County. Since then, the state has ignored the decisions of the district courts to the detriment and cost of individual beneficiaries. This is the first case that the Department of Human Services has appealed. I have three main points to make. One, that the federal law means what it says. Two, likewise, state law and policy mean what they say. Minnesota law and DHS policy require that an individual over the age of 64 show that he or she received fair market value when placing funds in a pooled special needs trust. The department can't put up an elusive fair market value standard and penalize individuals simply because they're 65 and older. And third, that Mr. Fosier's transfer of assets to the LSS pooled trust subaccount was a transfer for fair market value.
So you said this is the first time this case has been up to an appellate court.
That's right.
In Minnesota.
In Minnesota.
And so I'd ask both of you to answer this question. What would your syllabus point be if we were to publish?
That transfer of assets into a pooled trust I have 2 points. Number one, I think that the federal law allows the transfer of assets into a pooled trust subaccount for a person age 65 and older without even having to look at the fair market value issue. But second, and the issue that's on appeal today, is that if somebody is 64 and older and they place funds into a pooled trust, that Mr. Fosier's placement of these assets into the LSS pooled trust was a transfer for fair market value.
Well, let's start with the federal law. Why do you think federal law is clear on this point?
Because the section that Mr. Leonard pointed to, which is in the transfer provisions of the federal statute, that statute governs when somebody wants to go on medical assistance and they are giving assets to a third person, a child, a spouse, a person with a disability, a niece or a nephew with a disability. That section does not concern the individual, him or herself, establishing medical assistance by placing funds in a trust for him or herself. That statute is governed solely by the D provision of that federal statute. And I think when you read some of these cases that are out there about this issue, the decision to say that the requirement for 65 and under applies to a person like Mr. Fosier, it's a very tortured, sort of convoluted way to get there. But if you look at the dissent in the Cox decision, it outlines the argument so clearly about why the transfer provisions deal with transfers when you're giving the money somewhere else. And then the whole point of the trust section in OBRA 93 was to make sure that people couldn't give away money and then put it into trust somewhere else for somebody else's benefit and then go on medical assistance. And so the statute is actually very clear about how it makes sure that can't happen. There's a payback provision. The funds in the trust have to be used for the specific sole benefit of the individual. The trust has to be irrevocable. Why does it have to be irrevocable? So that it can only be used for the sole benefit of the individual. And at the death in Minnesota, if there's any money left, this pool trust gets to keep 10%. And the state gets the rest, all the way up to the amount of money they've spent. In all of those other cases, there's no limit to what the pool trust can keep or requirement that the state be paid back. And that's a huge difference between what's happening in these other cases and in the Minnesota case.
In your comment, counsel, I think the last point you make is that this is a very fact-specific determination.
I think it is. And that's why when you asked about the syllabus, what would I say? I think it is limited in this case. But I think that the idea and what we're grappling with in Minnesota is that district courts continually say, look, you have to show that there's fair market value, and we have shown that. I believe Mr. Fosier showed it at the hearing and in these other cases. And what the department says is, no, it's basically a matter of law. I mean, you can have all these other reasons, but what the Human Services judge found in this case is that it's a transfer because it's irrevocable and discretionary. Well, that's no different than saying you're over 65, and so it's a transfer for fair market value because the trust has to be irrevocable and discretionary. That discretion isn't limited, though. I mean, the discretion, the contract itself says, you know, we, Lutheran Social Service, will take your money, disabled individual, and we will pay you, we will make distributions for funds that supplement and don't supplant your medical assistance benefit. So it's not just limited to care and welfare. It could be tickets to the Chanhassen Dinner Theater. It could be taking your friends or going out to lunch, or it could be a myriad of things that people with disabilities, you know, when you're on medical assistance, you get to keep $3,000, you get $102 every month, and Mr. Fosier is like the quintessential pooled trust beneficiary. You know, he was disabled before he turned 65. That didn't change when he turned 65. He had a very limited amount of money that was put into the pool trust, and it could, so that it could be managed, and it would be used for those things that supplement his public benefits. And in that's why these laws were passed in the first place, to carve out an exception for people who were living their whole life with a disability and would never have the chance to have money again and could not pay for their own long-term care.
So, counsel, in your comments, it seems to me that you have answered the question I asked of appellant's counsel about who bears the burden of proof here. I mean, I appreciate that you are initially making an argument about how this statute 1396P should be construed, that would be a question
right.
of law. And, you know, it's an issue about how the law itself is stated.
Correct.
Whether this is a transfer of,
right.
of assets. On the other hand, if we get to the fair market value issue, it sounds to me you are acknowledging that that burden falls on Mr. Fosier. To
Correct.
Establish a transfer for fair market value or valuable consideration.
Right. I think at the first instance, when you look into the policy manual, the burden is on Mr. Fosier to show he had fair market value. Then once the county made its decision, when it went up to the administrative level, they had the burden of persuasion to say, this is why we made this decision. And, of course, the only reason they made the decision is because he was 65 and older. Mm-hmm. So they failed at that point.
Well, I appreciate why you get that reading from the HSJ decision. Well, particularly the county statements, the testimony that was provided. But in terms of the HSJ's decision, I think it's a little more complex than that, isn't it? It's not a straight age cutoff.
I think it is. I think the way that he decided the case, he gives lip service to what was presented at the hearing. But in his conclusions about fair market value, he didn't mention that at all. And he just said the two things. The quote that said, I don't think a reasonable person would ever put money into this pool trust, or an objective observer. And that's a personal opinion. And I think that's why the district court just said flat out,
it's a personal opinion about fair market value or valuable consideration. It's not a personal opinion about this age cutoff that we've made reference to.
No. All right. So, right. The age cutoff is something that in this particular case, we're saying, you know, if the court and if the department. They have decided in Minnesota that the age cutoff is relevant. Right or wrong, that's what they've decided. And so then they go to the next step that says, all right, if you're 65 and over, then you need to prove fair market value. So if I'm answering your question right, I think it's okay. that if you concede that if you're 65 and older, you have to show fair market value, then what the human services judge did was not acknowledging even that there could be a possibility of fair market value.
Okay. I think I understand. Thank you.
Okay.
What do we do with this July 2008 letter from the Chicago Regional Office?
Well, as you can imagine, that's when this all started. We were putting assets into pool trust before this. And it's been nationally an issue because some of the states allow it, some don't. CMS, this memo is not anything that any court has given deference to because we don't know really whether it was even looked at by a lawyer, and plus whether or not a state is going to say that you get anything of value when you put anything into a trust. It's a matter of state law, too. And so I say that memo should not be given any deference. And furthermore, you know, this has been law since 1993. And CMS has the means, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services and the federal government, if they really wanted to change this law, they have a legislative or an administrative process to do it. And what they've done is issued this memo that has language in it that's not clear. It may be a transfer. Okay, so if it may be a transfer, when is it a transfer? When is it not a transfer? And in our view, you know, for a person like Mr. Fosier, he put $28,000 into this pool trust. The initial inventory shows that he got that exact amount of money that was placed into the trust. The money in that trust has to be used for his sole benefit during the course of his life. When you talk about an objective buyer, what are you really talking about? I mean, using common sense, it's that a person who's not on medical assistance or could not and would not be able to set up a pooled trust like this. So, for instance, I couldn't do it. I'm not disabled, and I'm not on medical assistance. So I couldn't just put my money in even after age 65. I mean, you have to be found disabled by the state medical review team or the Social Security Administration before you even meet the threshold of being able to put money into this trust. And to say that nobody, you know, they have, in the record, it's 420 people in this Lutheran Social Service Pool Trust have placed their assets in here. And the idea that they couldn't get that money out, it's silly. Because when these people put their money in, they are trusting Lutheran Social Service when they say, you put your money in with us, we will pay for those goods and services that supplement and don't supplant government benefits.
Do you agree, Council, that it's Minnesota trust law that governs the terms and the enforcement of the trust agreement that we're dealing with here?
Ultimately, I do believe that Minnesota trust law is integral to understanding, you know, for instance, does Minnesota have a dry trust? Can somebody establish it without that? And U.S. v. Shaughnessy is a good case that shows, you know, that if you are in Minnesota, that even if you're a beneficiary of a solely discretionary trust, you still have legal rights to enforce that trust. It's a very interesting case, and I know it's been cited on both sides, but it's very instructive, I think, in terms of how Minnesota looks at the trust law. So yes, I do believe it's both Minnesota trust law and the federal law in terms of the pool trust.
Ms. Hansen, do you believe that the valuation date for valuable consideration or fair market value can be looked at prospectively?
I do.
What's the basis for that?
There's, first of all, intrinsic or other value can mean looking forward, and there's a specific citation in the POMS, which govern Social Security rules, that says that the fair consideration can be a contract or looking for, you know, getting the, I don't have the exact words, but moving forward.
And so here, the pooled trust, obviously the purpose is to provide these benefits that are not covered by MA prospectively.
Right.
You believe that would fit that definition of valuable consideration?
That would fit that definition of valuable consideration. And yes, he could have bought all those things. All of those things are personal items that would allow him to be on medical assistance. None of them would have thrown him off, but the idea is that he may need that over time. And certainly that's what the trust contemplated, is that it could be used over time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, the Eighth Circuit in the Olson case, just to address something that respondent brought up at the beginning of her argument, the Eighth Circuit in the Olson case expressly rejected the proposition that a transfer penalty applies only to transfers for the benefit of others. I don't believe that argument was made in respondent's brief, so I'm not sure if that citation is in the record, but it is 676 F3rd 688.
So is the Olson case cited in your brief, Counsel? Or are you? Because I will jot cite down otherwise.
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor.
Okay.
I know that that was an issue at the district court. Mm-hmm. I don't think that it was, but Counsel could correct me if I'm
that's
wrong.
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So Minnesota has two public policies that are relevant to this case. The first is that individuals should use all available resources to pay for the cost of long-term care services before turning to government assistance. And the second policy is that trusts should not be permitted to shield resources from such use. Those policies are made explicit in Minnesota Statute Section 501C.1206A. In this case, the record is absolutely clear that respondent transferred assets into a pooled trust for the sole purpose of shielding those assets while maintaining MA eligibility. Respondent does not dispute that. In fact,
can I just ask Mr. Leonard, though, and I thought even the human services judge found this. There's no dispute, though, that a pooled trust, again, forgetting the age for a moment, is specifically for the purpose of setting aside assets for the benefit of the recipient, things that are not covered by MA. So would that not mean then it's in the fact scenario here, the only difference being is the age, that there's no dispute that the way it's set up, those funds could only be used for those things, and we've talked about some of them that are not covered by MA.
That's correct, Your Honor. That it is to cover things not covered by MA. Congress did place an age cutoff on that, though, which is age 65. So in an individual in Mr. Foser's situation who is over 65 when he transfers the assets, Congress said that those transfers, those assets don't count toward eligibility only if it's for fair market value.
You know, it's here we have a district court back in 2017 ordering that the fiduciary transfer Foser's share from the home sale to a pooled trust. So you're not saying that that district court judge was trying to scam MA, were you?
No, Your Honor, absolutely not.
So what do we do with a fiduciary following a legitimate court order?
I don't think anyone, Your Honor, is arguing that the transfer was illegal. I will note, however, that the joinder agreement, which the fiduciary services attorney reviewed and signed, specifically stated, if my client is over the age of 65, I've advised my client of the position currently being taken by the government that such transfer may result in a period of ineligibility, and I've provided the trustee with a transfer penalty acknowledgement. So fiduciary services was well aware of the position that the government's taking. It appears they likely did not agree with that position and thought that their position was legally defensible. I'm not certainly imputing bad faith, but they were definitely aware of it, of the issue. Your Honor, so the rule that respondent's asking for in this case would be contrary, of course, to the two public policies of the state that I just mentioned. It would also be directly contrary to the two state Supreme Court cases to decide this issue in both the Cox case out of Iowa and then the pooled advocate trust case out of, I believe, South Dakota.
What would your syllabus point be?
Your Honor, my syllabus point would be that transfer of assets into a pooled trust is not a transfer for fair market value where the transferor receives nothing tangible with intrinsic value at the time of the transfer and receives only a speculative interest in receiving future payments. And the best, I think the...
You call it a speculative interest. Would you disagree with me if I called it an equitable interest?
No, Your Honor, as long as we're clear about what the equitable interest is, and I think the absolute best authority for that is the O'Shaughnessy case that respondent cites, which in very clear terms states that because discretionary trusts give the trustee complete discretion to distribute all, some, or none of the trust assets, the beneficiary has a, quote, mere expectancy in the non-distributed income and principal until the trustee elects to make a payment. I see that my time has elapsed. The commissioner respectfully requests that the court affirm the commissioner's decision in this matter.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
An interesting case, and we'll have our decision out within 90 days.